What's up, baby? It's Bretzky, and I'm here to tell you that SpinQuest.com is giving out free sweeps coins. All you gotta do is purchase a $10 coin pack, and guess what? They're gonna give you the coins from a $30 coin pack. That lets you play all your favorite games like Blackjack, Wanted, Dead or Wild, and we're talking real cash prizes, baby. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Save big on everything for your outdoor projects at Menards. We have everything you need to take care of your lawn. Revolutionize your lawn care routine with Menards Premium 4-in-1 Lawn Fertilizer. This one-step solution prevents crabgrass and kills and prevents weeds while keeping your lawn green for up to 4 months. Save big money on Menards Premium Fertilizer. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast, bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Good evening, listeners, and welcome to the Horror Hill podcast, part of the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights network. I'm Eric Peabody, your host and narrator, and this, dear friends, is the inaugural episode for Season 12. Regular listeners might have noticed a few changes to the format and audio processing, but don't worry, I'm still here to bring you some of the most harrowing horror fiction to be found. As some of you know, Chilling Tales put out an anthology collection a little while back, and we have an audio version set to be released later this month, narrated entirely by yours truly. To help whet your appetites, we're going to feature some stories from that collection for the first few episodes of this season. Tonight's stories, The Taking by Joshua L. Hood and You Can't Bluff Travis Tanner by T.W. Grimm, should give you a taste of what's in store. In the meantime, if you just can't wait to get your jagged little claws on this collection, then you're in luck. Head over to www.chillingbook.com to grab a copy for yourself, and at only $14.99 for the paperback and $4.99 for the ebook, it's quite a deal. 30 stories, along with illustrations, from authors such as Brian Martinez, author of The Vessel Horror Sci-Fi Podcast, Ted Hageman, author of Ted the Caver, and Chilling Tales mainstays such as Seth Paul, N.M. Brown, and myself. Also, be sure to keep an eye on our social media pages for updates. You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author Joshua L. Hood, I give you The Taking. For the 100th or more time, Liz stares down at the pages of her homework, half complete, due long ago. Her name is scrawled in the top corner next to the words 7th grade geometry. A thin layer of dust obscures the writing. She's in her favorite chair at the dining room table, the one that lets her see out the back window to where her mother tends the garden, growing candy cane radishes, her favorite. Her mother shakes the soil off her hands, looks at the baby monitor clipped to her belt, smiles, and goes back to work. Sarah must be mumbling in her sleep in that cute way she does. Liz loves to see that her mother is beginning to smile again. The front door clicks open and someone steps into the living room. Liz can't see the front door from the dining room table, but out of habit thinks, "Daddy?" Only to realize that her dad should still be at work. A set of heavy footsteps crosses the threshold, begins stomping the living room. Heavy, almost angry, slow. Liz freezes. No, those certainly aren't her dad's footsteps. Stomp, stomp, stomp. The sound crosses the carpeted floor and then changes to the sharp, hollow thunk of feet on hardwood. The stairs. They begin ascending, still slowly, like someone walking with lead weights on their feet. Mom is still outside, unaware of anything amiss. She should be hearing the sound on the baby monitor, shouldn't she? It's just at the top of the... Wait. The baby. Liz jumps at the thought. The nursery where Sarah is sleeping is just upstairs. Liz leaps up from her chair and charges around the corner into the living room. There's no one there, so she moves up the stairs quickly, almost floating. Nothing. The footsteps are just ahead of her, but she sees no one in the dim light. She looks behind her, back down the stairs, even up at the ceiling, but there is no one else in the hallway. Yet the footsteps persist, slowly plodding towards the nursery. They stop, only for a moment, and Liz sees the nursery door click open and swing wide. The sound of Twinkle Twinkle Little Star drifts out of the room where Sarah is sleeping. Liz takes a slow step towards it, but the footsteps, just moments after stepping into the room, have emerged again and are approaching where she stands. Instinctively, she steps aside to let them pass, shuddering as a wave of subtle heat passes by, inches away. She's frozen with fear, and for a moment the footsteps stop. She feels more than hears an imperceptible breath, as if someone breathing in through their nose the smell of a delicious meal. Then they stomp their way back through the living room and out the front door. When the door clicks shut, Liz shakes off her fear and rushes into the baby's room. Sarah is sleeping fitfully but safely in her crib. Another door opens from downstairs, and Liz hears Mom's sing-song voice. "Coming, dear. Sounds like someone needs a hug." Liz remembers hugs and wishes Mom was referring to her. That night at dinner, Liz sees her parents laugh for the first time in a long time. Sarah is cooing and splatting around in her mushed radishes, flinging bits of glop all across the table. A bit hits her mother in the face, and Dad laughs a little harder. Mom slaps his arm playfully. Sarah, picking up on the playful attitude, flings more mush, dropping her spoon directly into it and sending the biggest splatter yet clear across the table. a small chunk of radish lands in the middle of Liz's homework papers. The laughter stops. Dad clears his throat. Mom looks a little startled, then ashamed, then places her hands on Sarah's chubby little arms to calm her down. A moment of silence descends on the dining room. Dad clears his throat again and uses a napkin to swab away the glop from the paper, leaving a muddy little smudge in the coating of dust. "Maybe it's time we put those away," Mom mutters quietly, as though she doesn't want to be heard. Dad says nothing, but gives her a sympathetic look, one with a hint of agreement.
"They can't be forgetting about me already."
Liz feels a wave of sadness pass over her.
"It's only been 6 months."
She sniffles. She loves to see her parents happy again and is glad they have Sarah to bring them joy, but she'd give anything to be a part of it again. "Let's talk about it later," Dad finally says. "I think we're disturbing Sarah."
"Yes,"
Mom agrees. "She is very sensitive." Liz places her hand protectively on the homework papers, wondering why she'd ever hated homework so much when she was alive, but her thoughts are suddenly interrupted by the sound of footsteps coming through the front door in the living room. Stomp, stomp, stomp. She looks at her parents, expecting them to react in some way that would tell her how to feel, but they're focused on cleaning up Sarah and don't seem to notice. Stomp, stomp, stomp. The footsteps grow louder. They're not going for the stairs this time, but coming closer. Still, her parents don't react. Stomp. Stomp. They come into the dining room and stop just at the head of the table. If there had been someone attached to those footsteps, they would have been standing just behind the high chair, close enough to touch. And yet, her parents still do nothing. Liz feels the wave of warmth, same as before, but no longer a gentle heat. Now it's stronger, almost uncomfortable, and it stinks. Sarah, as sensitive as Mom had just said, struggles to look behind her, simultaneously erupting into a banshee-like cry that startles everyone. Dad pulls her from the high chair and stands up, bouncing her in a comforting way, which seems to help a little. As they pass through where Liz knows the feet had stopped, the warmth flares up for a moment, and then, seconds later, the footsteps, as loud as ever, stomp their way back out the front door. Liz stares at the smudge on her homework. Mom is pulling weeds. Dad is at work. Sarah is asleep. The mushed radish smudge on her homework has dried out, leaving a gross little streak that she's powerless to do anything about. She's tried to scrape it away, to preserve this shrine to her memory just as they all liked it, but it was too exhausting. Interacting with the world always was, and became more so every day. But that was last night. Right now, she's not thinking about radishes. She's thinking about the footsteps. There's something so foreboding about them. Could they be another ghost? If so, how come she hadn't noticed before now? And why did it seem drawn to her sister? Her sister. Sarah seemed to be somehow aware of the thing. Was she able to hear it? See it? Could she maybe see Liz? No, that's not it. Liz had tried to communicate several times. It took too much energy,
too much willpower that she didn't have to bring herself to the attention of the living. But Sarah is special. Sensitive, her mother called it. Maybe she could... Suddenly, the air grows warmer. A bad smell comes with it, familiar but hard to place. Liz steels herself, knowing what to expect. The front door opens. Footsteps sound from the living room, stomp up the stairs, down the hall. She wills herself after them, ignoring walls and doors, and arrives in the nursery at the same time that the footsteps do. But once again, there's nothing there. "Who are you?" she demands the empty air. Only silence greets her, somehow worse than any response she could imagine. Moments pass, heat pulsing, memories of having a heartbeat. That smell. Sulfur? Then, stomp, stomp, stomp. The footsteps move back out the door and down the stairs. Liz stands near the crib, where Sarah is plainly having a bad dream. She wishes she could comfort her. The front door creaks shut in the distance, but not before a sound floats through Liz's mind. A sound like gravel under a car tire. A thought pushed into her mind without consent. "Soon," it seems to say, and the door clicks shut.
Forget everything you had planned for this weekend because you are sitting on your couch and winning from the comfort of your own home. I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play hundreds of slot games, all of the table games you love, and you could even win real cash prizes. New users, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Liz thinks wildly. She knows Sarah's in danger, but doesn't know how. All that evening, as her parents eat dinner, play with Sarah, watch TV, and generally go on with life without her, she thinks about the thing in the nursery. That smell, sulfur, can only mean one thing. She might have only been 12, but she knew a demon when she smelled one. So far, it had come every day, but sporadically, never at a set time. She'd have to be vigilant. Good thing she didn't have much else to do. That night, she waits, hovering by the crib that used to be hers, watching over her infant sister. A sign of moving on, her parents had said to themselves in whispers. A sense of resentment threatens the room, but Liz quells it. The baby is already sleeping uneasily, like always when Liz is around. Her little mind has no idea that she is being protected, not just haunted. Liz tries to ignore the sense of injustice. She has work to do. The night passes quietly until just before sunrise when... Stomp, stomp, stomp. Liz braces herself. The heat flares up and the sulfur smell surges into clarity as the thing, the demon, enters the room.
"Who are you?"
Liz once again demands of the footsteps. This time, it responds.
"Away with you, trifling thing."
A voice, low and gravelly, growls from nowhere. It travels through Liz's mind in a way that makes her wonder if she heard it or thought it. She feels the strong push to flee the room, but resists.
"What do you want with my sister?"
she quavers. The gravelly voice seems just a little bit surprised.
Strong will for a human spirit, it growls dismissively. Then, without answering, leaves the way it came in, stomping down the stairs. Distantly, as though speaking to itself, a sound, thought, floats up the stairs to Liz. Tomorrow, it mutters and seems happy.
The day goes by with the silent routine of a family who doesn't know it's in danger. Liz is at her chair in the dining room, agitated. Mom is picking tomatoes. Sarah watches her from a bassinet in the shade. Dad will be home soon. Liz knows that she has to do something, but it will take all of her energy, maybe all of her being, leaving nothing left. But that's okay. Her parents are laughing again, so it's okay. Maybe, when she's gone, they can finally forget about her. No, she stops herself, a single mote of dust swirling off the geometry page in a cold draft. No, that thought isn't as comforting as she'd expected it to be. It hurts. Focus, she tells herself. I think I know what to do. Immediately after sunset, when ghosts are the strongest, she goes to work. Using all the power of will at her disposal, she manages to nudge the family Bible off the bookshelf and kick it across the floor to the stairs. She focuses all her energy to carry it into the nursery, a difficult feat for a ghost to manage on even the darkest nights, and hides it in plain sight on the table by the crib. Next, she goes into the room where her parents are sleeping and gently, with great intention, unclasps the crucifix that hangs around her mother's neck. Her mother stirs, but only briefly. For a moment, she considers waking her mother, trying to talk to her, to tell her she's here and that she still loves her, that it wasn't her fault. But no, she's tried that before. Didn't work. Too exhausting. Save your energy, Liz, she tells herself. This is more important.
Stomp, stomp, stomp. The footsteps are early. Liz quails, but only for a moment.
It must have passed midnight and become tomorrow. She clutches the silver chain in her nothing hands. It feels like a lead weight to her, but she drags it and herself into the nursery. The footsteps will be there soon.
The trifling thing is still here, the demon grates, somehow sensing her presence. Will you watch and despair? It asks.
Watch what? Liz asks, positioned between the crib and the door.
The taking, it growls.
Liz trembles, and the heat subsides in her cold fear. The demon breathes in.
The fear of ghosts is weak and delicate, a rare thing, it says matter-of-factly.
What do you mean, the taking? Liz presses on. You mean possession, right?
She almost stutters the word. The demon rumbles a growl.
Why, Sarah? Go away!
Away? You dare to command? I will not leave a vessel like this. Seldom is one born with so open a soul. And tonight, the auspices decree she is ripe for the taking, and I shall take my place in her.
Sulfur and heat inflame the room like an infection to a wound. "No," Liz said, and then, more forcefully, "No, not if I have anything to say about it." Like lifting a brick, she raises the tiny silver crucifix. Cold wind swirls the room for a moment, long enough to flutter open the pages of the Bible to the Book of Mark, where Jesus casts out unclean spirits. The demon growls angrily as Liz begins to read. It's not much of an exorcism, but she didn't know what else to do. It worked in the movies. Sometimes. Stomp. Stomp. The footsteps begin to recede towards the door, reluctantly. "No," the demon rages. "Not tonight. I shall not be cast out." Stomp. A struggling step forward. Liz flings the crucifix at the sound. It bounces off of the thing unseen with a sharp, low growl, but the thing doesn't stop. Stomp. "No!" Liz screams, remembering her parents' laughter, how she's missed it, and how she doesn't want to lose it again. "Leave Sarah alone!" She sees in her mind her mother smile at the little monitor on her belt, beaming love for her one and only. It used to be two, but no, never mind that now. She focuses. "Not my family!" Her will to resist rises. "She is mine!" A gust of ice-cold air. An enraged howl. Infernal curses. Then, the demon, the smell, and the heat all fly out to the nursery door, slamming it shut behind them. Sarah wakes up. She's crying. Soon enough, Mom and Dad are clamoring down the hallway to see what was wrong. They sleepily stumble into the room. Dad steps on the crucifix and mutters a confused curse. Mom casts a curious eye askance at the Bible, but then goes to Sarah. Soon, their confusion is forgotten, and they're huddled together, rocking and humming to the baby. Liz sighs in relief. They can be happy again. She's saved them. Sarah stops crying as her parents pepper her with kisses and hugs and jokes that a baby can't understand. Soon she's cooing at them, and they all smile together. Liz stands next to them, places her nothing hand on her mom's shoulder. But she can't feel it. They don't know what she's done. They don't even know that she's there. She aches again with all her heart to be a part of this family, to come back to them. They should be looking at her like that, like they used to. A cloudy notion floats through her mind. Maybe they could? Liz looks at the infant. What had the demon said? An open soul? The cloudy notion became an idea. They could look at her like that again. They could. She just has to. Liz steps towards the baby, the open soul. To take.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
You've been listening to The Taking by Joshua L. Hood. Joshua L. Hood is a Boise, Idaho-based illustrator and writer of speculative fiction, and has had his work featured in several published anthologies. His own collection of short stories, Melting People, 11 short stories of the bizarre and unexpected, is available on Amazon. He has been fascinated with the unknown since childhood. When he's not exploring the mysteries of possibility through writing and illustration, he does so through his fledgling career as an archaeologist. Now, to close out our episode, here's You Can't Bluff Travis Tanner by T.W. Grimm. Richie Gold slumped through the night with dead eyes and a gut full of roiling stomach acid, his hands shoved deep in his empty pockets against the cold. He'd messed up tonight, worse than he'd ever messed up in an entire lifetime of crapping the bed at almost every opportunity. There was simply no way he was going to magically parachute to a soft landing, not this time. He was up the metaphorical creek, and there wasn't a paddle in miles. "They'll break my arms," Richie thought, and he felt the first stirrings of panic in his chest. A quick fluttering of his heart, there and gone, and then he was completely numb again. "Shock. You're in shock, numbskull, like after a car accident. Savor the numbness while it lasts." Richie had sold his car and cleaned out his bank account to buy his way in. The game was hosted in a back room of a pawn shop, owned and operated by a fine and upstanding local businessman named Big Jerry Kinsella. There were only 6 chairs at the table, and it cost a cool $5,000 to sit your ass down on one of those chairs. Richie had been able to raise exactly $9,000. It wasn't much, not for a game like this, but it was enough to give him a fighting chance. All he had to do was have one good streak, get some momentum going, and he could take the whole thing home. All he needed was his God-given prowess at the poker table, a few good hands, and a sweet little blessing from Lady Luck. Just a little one, and Golden Richie would carry it the rest of the way. Richie lost it all in just under 2 hours. He had seriously underestimated the caliber of players he would be facing at that particular table. This was on brand for Richie, who was supremely terrible at risk assessment. He watched the last of his chips get swept away, every dime he had in the world, and he said, "Mr. Kinsella, can I have a word with you in private?" Big Jerry gave him a nasty, gold-toothed grin from his perch atop a bar stool in the corner. He threw his toothpick into an ashtray on the folding table beside him and let out a big, theatrical sigh. "Why don't you do yourself a favor and walk away, kid?" Jerry's tone was kindly, nurturing even, but his eyes were cold as ice. Richie got up from the table and approached Jerry with his hands held out in front of him in a prayer position. In a soft, breathless rush, he stammered, "Just $5,000, Jerry, Mr. Kinsella. $5,000 and I'll pay back every dime before I walk out that door. I just need a little..." "You need a helping hand," Jerry finished, and his grin faded into a thin, harsh line beneath his bulbous nose. "You gotta understand something, kid, and I'm being very serious here, so listen to me, okay? You gotta pay it all back, with interest. I charge 50%, no exceptions." Yeah, I get that, Mr. Kinsella. Of course, I can..." Jerry interrupted Richie's groveling with a loud snap of his fingers. He poked a blunt digit into Richie's chest and said, "Those guys sitting over there at the table, they've got all the money they need. That's why they're here. They ain't gonna lose their shirt. Now you, I let you in because I felt sorry for you, Richie, and that's the truth. I don't even need your money. I just felt sorry for you. And look what happened. Should I really be helping you dig yourself even deeper? I don't know, kid. Richie felt his eyes fill with tears. He gasped, Jerry, please, I gotta get it back. I lost everything I had. Come on, I'm good for it. I swear it on my mother. Please. $10,000, Jerry snapped. That's what you get. Five ain't even worth getting my ass up off this stool. You get 10, you give me 15. And count yourself lucky I don't make it 16 for being a pain in the ass, got it? Sure, Jerry, Richie panted. He hated the desperate whine in his voice, but he couldn't seem to make it stop. Yeah, sure, I get it. Thank you. Thank you so much. You won't regret this. Whatever he loans this dingbat, it's going to be mine pretty soon, one of the other players chuckled, and the rest of them laughed. Big Jerry frowned at him in disapproval. Can it, Vinny? We don't use antagonistic language at my table, you know that. You know what? I hope the kid cleans you out. Teach us some manners. Jerry heaved himself up and lumbered over to a storage closet. He rummaged around and came back with $10,000 worth of chips in a nicotine-stained chip rack. He plunked it into Richie's hands and, in a very serious tone of voice, he said, You take these over to the table and there ain't no turning back. You sure about this, kid? Oh, Richie was sure about it, all right. He was more than sure. He was absolutely 100% frickin' positive. He thumped the chip rack onto the table and growled, Let's play some cards, fellas. 45 minutes later, Big Jerry was escorting Richie out the back door, steering him along with a very firm grip on his shoulder. Richie was in a daze. He wasn't sure if he was awake or if the whole thing was just a very vivid nightmare. It had to be a nightmare. Surely he hadn't actually tanked himself this badly. Surely not. That would be insane, wouldn't it? 7 days, Big Jerry said, and he gave Richie's shoulder a painful squeeze. Be here by noon. Don't make me come looking for you, kid, and don't you dare show up with no money and a bunch of excuses. Richie opened his mouth to speak, and Jerry swung the door shut on his reply. Clunk. Richie gaped at the door for a while in a near catatonic state of disbelief, shivering in the frigid wind, and then he shoved his hands in his pockets and started walking. $15,000. How in the blue, frozen hell was he supposed to come up with 15 large in 7 days? Richie ran through the options with a sour grimace on his face, his chin tucked down against the cold and the collar of his jacket pulled up high around the back of his neck. What could he do to get that much money in the space of a week? He'd have to commit a robbery. What else was he going to do, play the frickin' stock market? It would have to be theft, and theft on a large scale. Bank robbery was too risky. Convenience stores were a safer option, but he'd have to hit literally dozens of them to come up with all the cash. Maybe robbery was a bad idea. He might be better off pawning his 38 special and taking the money to the track instead. There were always the slot machines, too. Playing the slots could really pay off. Maybe he should... Hell no, Richie muttered out loud. Slot machines? Are you stupid or something? He couldn't realistically do a bank job and expect to get away with it. And there was no point in possibly getting shot in the face while holding up a mom-and-pop operation for the 87 bucks in their till. So, what then? What could he do? His train of thought was abruptly scuttled by a gravelly voice in his head. The voice was drunk to the point of slurring its words, and it was hoarse from yelling over the loud music. The voice said, It's near the corner of Ambassador and 3rd Avenue. Weird little place. Sells dream catchers and fake shrunken heads. Mystical shit like that. They had been having a smoke outside a strip club, an establishment of questionable repute called the Blue Review. It was a guy he knew from way back, when he'd done a short stretch in a juvenile detention center for shoplifting. What was his name again? Dallas. His name was Dallas. He was a car thief with a heavy coke habit and a sex addiction. Places like the Blue Review were his second home. Dallas was filling him in on the details of an easy score he'd heard about through the grapevine. Dallas was all about the easy score. He said,
"I know someone that, like, knows someone who worked there a few years back, right? They said there's a safe in his office and there's mad stacks of cash in there. You know what I'm saying? Jewelry, rare coins, all kinds of goodies in that safe. Old guy that runs the place is weird as hell, but he's harmless. Real Bela Lugosi vibe to him. Strange old dude for real, but he's an old ass man and he's in there all by himself. It would be easy, that's all I'm saying here, bro. It would be so easy. Hey, you want another bump?"
"Mad stacks," Richie murmured to himself. "I could use some mad stacks right about now, or I'm gonna have to learn how to wipe my ass with my feet." Uncharted Waters, that was what the place was called, near the corner of Ambassador and Third. A safe full of cash, jewels, and rare collectibles. Jerry Kinsella would be more than willing to accept such items as payment for the loan. It was possible Richie could make out pretty good after he paid his debt. Maybe even really good. Who knows?
"This has to be real," Richie yelled. "You better not have been bullshitting me, you crackhead."
A group of rough-looking young men happened to be walking past at that moment, and they all swiveled their heads to stare at him with uniform hostility. One of them snapped,
"Fuck is you talking about?"
And Richie promptly cast his eyes down at the sidewalk, hurrying off into the thickening gloom to fetch his gun from his bedside table. "That's a good question, man," Richie breathed. "That's a really good question." Uncharted Waters was a hole in the wall consisting of one room that was crammed right to the ceiling with all kinds of bizarre and worthless junk. There were necklaces made from the ears and mummified paws of various unidentified animals hanging in the window. There were incomplete mannequins, old movie posters, used clothing, moldy books about witchcraft, and candles of all kinds. There was so much stuff crammed in there, it was almost disorienting. The proprietor was a gaunt, pallid old fellow who stiffly introduced himself by saying,
"Melville Rawlings, proprietor and a confirmed explorer of Uncharted Waters. Here, have a matchbook."
Even though he had a pretty decent stoop going on, Melville was still taller than Richie by several inches, and Richie stood just a hair shy of 6'1". Melville was wearing a foreboding black suit with a dark red tie. He looked like a sinister funeral home director in an old horror movie.
"You're in luck, sir. I was just about to close for the night. Are you looking for anything in particular?"
Melville steepled his long fingers together in a solicitous manner and waited for a response. Richie absently shook his head and said,
"No, sir. I just wanted to look around."
He was staring at a locked display case, a dusty rectangle of glass that was bolted to the front counter. It contained only one item, the most unusual-looking deck of cards Richie had ever seen. The backs of the cards were adorned with intricate patterns and characters, black text over a vivid red background. The figure seemed to swim and undulate before his eyes, a mesmerizing and clever optical illusion.
"These cards are something else. I've never seen anything like that before. What's that lettering? Do you know? What language is it?"
"I have no idea, sir, and I don't believe anyone has ever tried to find out.
No one knows but Travis Tanner, the man who commissioned this work of art, and possibly the artist himself. It was an artist of some renown at the time, as I recall. Like so many of those who are afflicted with genius, the poor young fellow was deeply troubled. He committed suicide not long after he finished these cards, as the story goes. As I remember it, he broke into a botanical garden and hung himself from a Judas tree. Richie nodded mechanically and said, "Wow, that's crazy." He was trying his best to appear engaged by the conversation, but he was only half listening to what the old man was saying. Richie had never robbed anyone before. He wasn't a stick-up man, for crying out loud. He was an unlucky gambler and mediocre card shark. His nerves were screaming, and he was holding the .38 inside his jacket pocket in a death grip. All he could think was, "I could get 10 years for armed robbery. That's big boy jail, not the county lockup. I wouldn't last more than a week tops. I wouldn't want to." Those cards have been held by some of the most notorious villains of modern times. Melville plowed on, seemingly oblivious to Richie's sweaty forehead and twitchy demeanor. Travis Tanner was a gambler of great infamy, and he ran in infamous circles. John Dillinger held those cards, and members of the Barker clan, too. Senators, mayors, police chiefs and judges, mafioso and business magnates. Many powerful people and dangerous people. And every single one of them lost. No one could beat Travis Tanner at cards. No one. "That so?" Richie asked in a small, papery little voice. He wasn't feeling so hot. In fact, he felt like he might actually pass the hell out and collapse onto the yellowing floor tiles. He should have just come bursting in with a balaclava and fired a shot into the ceiling. Just charge the hell in and get the job done fast. Why did he decide to play it cool and scope out the room first? There was nothing in there but one elderly Vincent Price-looking dude and his endless mounds of junk. What had he been expecting? A team of heavily armed Navy SEALs? He could have been gone by now, for Christ's sake. His opponents were often quoted as saying, "You can't bluff Travis Tanner." I can assure you the cards have not been marked, Mr. Gold. Yet Travis Tanner always knew when to call, when to hold, and when to fold. He was unbeatable. Richie snorted. If he was cleaning everyone out like that, it has to be a loaded deck. No one has that kind of luck. Melville offered him an enigmatic smile. He picked up an ornate letter opener from atop a stack of bills on the front counter and absently fingered the sharp tip. Perhaps. It was rumored that Travis Tanner was very interested in the occult, automatic writing, seances, things of that nature. He was a very intimidating man, tall and strong, always cloaked in black. Even the most ruthless of the gangsters who faced him across the poker table were at least a little bit afraid of him. No one ever tried to rob him of his winnings, which, coincidentally, is exactly why you're here, isn't it, Mr. Gold? To commit a robbery. Richie did a double take and gaped at the old man in shock. He pulled the gun out of his pocket and grunted, "The safe. Take me to the safe and you won't get hurt." "Safe?" Melville repeated, and he uttered a dry, mirthless little chuckle. He seemed completely unconcerned by the presence of the gun. "There is no safe. My only possession of any real value is this deck of cards. It is priceless. However, I cannot allow them to fall into your hands. They were bestowed upon me by Travis Tanner himself as he lay on his deathbed. I will most certainly not allow them to be stolen by a lowly scoundrel such as you." "Do as I say, Pops," Richie grimaced, "or you'll get hurt." Melville growled, "Oh, I believe we'll both get hurt." and his arm lashed out with lightning speed, shoving the gun to the side. At the same time, he swung at Richie with the letter opener. Richie jerked back just in time to avoid having his throat slashed wide open. The shop proprietor took another swing, this time opening a red line across Richie's forehead. An immediate ooze of blood poured into his eyebrows. Richie desperately backpedaled and pulled the trigger. The shot went over Nelville's shoulder, shattering a ceramic vase into a million fragments as Nelville bullied into him, trying his best to thrust the letter opener into the younger man's guts with a sewing machine motion. Richie missed another shot and blundered into an overladen shelf, knocking it to the floor as his feet tangled together. He fell on his ass in the wreckage, dropping the .38 in the process, and then Nelville swooped upon him like a bird of prey. Nelville screeched, "It's closing time, Mr. Gold!" and tried his very best to sink his makeshift dagger into Richie's heart. Richie struggled to control his arm, straining with all his might to keep the letter opener from sinking into his chest. The old man was eerily fast and incredibly strong. He leered down at Richie with a maniac's raging lust for bloodshed, cackling in delight as Richie desperately fought for his life beneath him.
"I'll put you with the rest of them," Nelville panted. "You'll be in fine company very soon, Mr. Gold."
He bore down against Richie's trembling arms with immense force. Richie bucked wildly and twisted away with a desperate scream. The letter opener grazed across the side of his neck, splitting skin and releasing fresh drops of crimson along the way, and the tip stuck into the floor with a muted thunk. Richie took this opportunity to turn his head and sink his teeth into the hand clutching the weapon, crunching into his assailant's thumb with the savagery of mortal terror. Neville roared in pain and tried to jerk his hand away. Richie bit down even harder and bucked his hips again, heaving the old man off balance and making him fall to the side. Richie gave him a two-legged donkey kick in the guts and rolled out of reach. He popped up and crawled across the room on his hands and knees, scrambling to retrieve his gun. Behind him, Nelville bellowed,
"Here I come, child! Here I come to rip out your eyes!"
Richie rolled over onto his back, the gun thrust out in front of him in a two-handed grip. The elderly madman was almost upon him, closing the distance between them with that eerie, fluid speed that belied his years. Richie screamed and squeezed the trigger three times, his eyes narrowed into slits. Three deafening explosions shivered the storefront windows, and Nelville fell onto the floor beside him. Richie shimmied away from him on his rear end, pushing with his heels so he wouldn't have to drop his arms. Nelville was in no condition to come after him again. He was curled up on his side like a dying bug, burbling out a thick mixture of blood and mucus as he stared at Richie with naked hatred. His ears were ringing from the gunshots, but Richie could read the old man's lips well enough to piece together his last words.
"I'll see you soon, Mr. Gold."
Forget everything you had planned for this weekend because you are sitting on your couch and winning from the comfort of your own home. I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play hundreds of slot games, all of the table games you love, and you could even win real cash prizes. New users, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
The old man's eyes went glassy, and Richie slowly lowered the gun. His arms were shaking uncontrollably. He wiped a sheet of blood off his forehead with his shirt and wheezed,
"What the hell? Oh man, what the...
All at once, the enormity of it all came crashing down on Richie, hurtling down upon his head like a cartoon grand piano with the words, "All of my screw-ups," written across the side in bold letters. He let out a keening sob and promptly vomited a sour spray of bile across the blood-spattered floor tiles.
"I gotta bounce," he whispered, and heaved himself to his feet.
He wiped some more blood out of his eyes with his shirt and staggered through the mess left behind by his life-or-death struggle with the homicidal proprietor, searching for the door to the fabled back room, which was home to the fabled safe. A safe which, according to Dallas, the coked-out car thief, could magically solve all of his rapidly snowballing problems in one fell swoop. There were three doors at the back of the shop. He discovered a musty little bathroom with a profoundly rust-stained toilet behind the first one and an equally musty little broom closet behind the second.
"Come on, baby,"
Richie begged the remaining door. He was dimly aware that he was starting to cry.
"Come on, come on, come on!"
The last opened into a small office. Richie threw back his head and released a triumphant wolf howl at the ceiling. He ransacked the cluttered room in a state of rapidly increasing panic, but he couldn't find a safe. He tore the room apart, even ripping gaping holes in the drywall in the vain hope there might be a hidden wall safe, but it simply wasn't there. The safe didn't exist. Dallas was full of shit. Richie hurled an antique snow globe against a wall, shattering it into fragments, and he screeched,
"Of course he was full of shit, you dummy! He's a friggin' cokehead! What did you expect?"
Richie ran into the main showroom and made a beeline for the exit. He was an idiot of colossal proportions, and it was high time to get the hell out of there. He shoved open the door, took one step outside, and abruptly stopped dead in his tracks. "It is priceless," the old man had said. "Priceless." Richie went back inside, his face a writhing mass of conflicting emotions as he smashed open the display case on the counter with the butt of the .38. The cards felt strangely warm in his hands. Richie shoved the deck into his pocket, cast a final glance over his shoulder at the body on the floor, and ran off into the night. The cut on his neck wasn't too bad, but there was a gaping wound on his forehead. Richie rooted through his ancient first aid kit and closed it up with a roll of decidedly mildewed-looking medical tape. It was going to leave a fearsome scar behind when it healed. When he was all patched up, Richie sat down at his kitchen table and examined the cards under the glare of the naked 60-watt bulb that dangled overhead. He was surprised to discover the dense block of characters and symbols was exactly the same on each card. It was a marvel of artistic skill and a testament to the artist's patience. "No wonder the guy killed himself," Richie grunted. "This would have drove anyone nuts." The artwork on the face cards was almost photorealistic in its fine detail, and the results were downright disturbing. The Jacks appeared to be suffering from the last stages of advanced syphilis or some other degenerative necrotic disease. Madness glinted in their eyes, and there were raw holes in their faces where their noses had completely rotted away. The Queens were cruel beauties with vampiric features, four unholy seductresses with ghostly white skin and pointed canines. Conversely, the Kings all had a subtly canine appearance. They possessed wild manes of matted hair, bushy beards, and there was the suggestion of pointed ears beneath their gilded crowns. The face cards were pretty heinous, but the Joker cards took the cake. One Joker was a gruesome caricature of the Grim Reaper in a jester's outfit, its mummified skull leering out from beneath a fool's cap with a coxcomb crest. The other appeared to be a prisoner, openly sobbing as he performed a barefooted, shuffling dance in a striped convict's uniform. It seemed to be implied that the poor fellow was being forced to dance for the amusement of his jailers. "This is creepy as hell," Richie murmured. The artist had gone all out to make the cards as unsettling as possible. Even the numbers and the symbols for the various suits were drawn in a manner that was somehow wild, dark, and strangely primal. They looked like ancient and talismanic characters from a forgotten age. The artwork was decidedly uncomfortable to look at, but the deck felt good in his hands. It felt right. The cards danced between his palms with ease as he shuffled them, and they almost seemed to glide through the air as he practiced dealing to invisible players around the table. They fell right where he wanted them to fall, each and every time. Richie dealt a few hands of seven-card stud to his table of non-existent opponents, and he ended up with a full house, jacks over kings. Richie whistled and said, "Well, damn. Try her again." He gave the deck a good shuffle and dealt another hand. This time, he wound up with four nines and a queen as the kicker. The next hand ended with Richie once again dominating with two pair, kings and aces. Richie stared at his cards and shook his head in wonder. It didn't seem possible, but the proof was laid out before his very eyes. If he could somehow get a dealer to use this marvelous new deck, well, he'd dominate. No doubt about it, he'd take the pot each and every time. The cards were marvelous. The cards were incredible. The cards were literally the best thing to ever happen to Richie Gold in his entire life. But the cards were also a little bit scary, weren't they? They were disturbingly warm to the touch. The phrase, "warm as freshly spilled blood," popped into his head, and he immediately swept it away. No, thank you. Still, Richie couldn't help but wonder. If the cards were as old and well-used as Nelville had indicated, why were they in such shockingly pristine condition? They looked like they'd never been handled without protective gloves, let alone tossed around 1,000 grimy tables in 1,000 smoky barrooms. How was that even possible? Thinking about it made him feel uneasy. Richie spread the cards out in a fan and stared at them for a while, deep in thought. He'd always win, Richie told his empty kitchen. Every single hand. No one could beat him. He could still pawn the 38 and get a little cash together. In fact, it would actually be a smart move to get rid of the gun, now that it was a weapon in a murder investigation. He knew a fence across town who would take any firearm, no questions asked. He could bring that money and his new deck to a table somewhere, and he'd clean house. But how would he ever get the dealer to use his cards? They weren't going to go for that. The dealer would automatically assume something was rotten in the state of Denmark, and they'd be right. Or would they take a look at the characters on the back of the cards and blankly nod at his request? Is that what that stuff was for? Of course. It's a spell, Richie chuckled. That's exactly what it is. A spell, an incantation, some kind of black magic voodoo. It makes it so they don't notice anything is wrong. Richie downed a couple of beers to soothe the nerves, and even though he wasn't hungry in the least, he forced himself to eat the only thing in his fridge, a half-eaten cardboard container of leftover lo mein noodles from last night's takeout. He drank two more brews for extra liquid courage, shrugged on his ratty old coat, and tugged a hat low over his forehead. Richie looked at himself in the mirror by the door, and he saw a wreck of a man with a sordid past and haunted eyes. It was time to change all that. It was time for Golden Richie to finally live up to his name. Richie tucked the cards in his pocket, said a silent prayer to whoever might be listening, and went out into the night to find himself a game. It was exceedingly easy to get people to use his new deck. All he had to do was put it on the table in front of the dealer and say, "We're using these babies tonight." Everyone in the room would look over at the deck and say, "Yeah, sure, whatever." It was instant hypnosis. They weren't even aware it wasn't a normal deck. They would stare blithely at the syphilitic jacks and not even raise an eyebrow. It was as if the true appearance of the cards was somehow obscured to their eyes by a mirage. It was amazing. It made Richie feel powerful. Richie hit two different games that night, and he came back to his grubby little apartment a little over $3,000 richer. He laid the money out on the table and smiled at it, drinking the last beer in the fridge with a zest for life he hadn't felt in years. He had 6 days to make up the rest of the debt. He didn't foresee it being much of a problem, not now. "Golden Richie," he grinned to himself. "Damn straight. Pure gold." Richie called his place of work and left a message that detailed why and exactly how his manager could go screw himself. He collapsed on his sagging little cot in a state of delirious relief. He was going to be okay. Better than just okay. He was going to be golden, now and forever. That night, he dreamed he was standing in the disastrous mess he'd left behind in the curio shop. He watched in mute horror as a towering shadow drifted right through the closed door and rolled across the room. It paused for a moment to examine the dead body on the floor, then continued on to hover in front of the empty display case. It floated there for a few moments, as if it were contemplating the theft of the cards. The sinister shape turned to face Richie, and his heart froze in his chest. The horrible thing showed Richie a single card, which it then laid face up amongst the shards of broken glass on the counter. It was one of the jokers from Travis Tanner's magic deck, The Prisoner. Richie could see the joker's face was actually his own. His eyes had been torn from their sockets. The raw, bleeding holes were shockingly dark against the pallor of his skin. "I'm sorry," Richie squealed, and he felt hot wetness spread across his crotch and run down his leg. "I didn't even want them, I swear! I needed money and... The dark figure raised its arm to show Richie what it held in its hand. It was a letter opener. "Here I come for your eyes," it whispered. Richie woke up screaming. As he sat there in the dark, panting for breath with a film of sour sweat drying on his skin, he realized something that chilled him to the bone. Even though Richie had never introduced himself, the old man had somehow known his name. The rest of the week was a hectic fog of looking for card games and mopping up the competition. Richie was unstoppable. Word spread about Golden Richie's unexplainable winning streak, and he was soon forced to rent a car to expand his search for the big money jackpot. By the time his week-long grace period was over, Richie was up by a jaw-dropping $56,000, and he was banned from every card table in the county. That didn't matter, though. As soon as he was square with Big Jerry Kinsella, Richie intended to take his show on the road. He would blaze a trail across the country and back again, rooking the rubes and folding the pros until he had himself a mansion, a fleet of luxury cars, and a Rolex for every day of the week. Richie had big plans. Big, glorious plans. Richie showed up at Kinsella's Pawn and Loan at exactly 12 noon. He was decked out in a three-quarter-length leather jacket, Gucci sunglasses, and a pair of gleaming Paul Stewart-branded derby shoes. Jerry came around the counter to greet him with a big, insincere smile and a hard clap on the shoulder.
"Well, if it ain't Golden Richie," he chuckled. "Look at you, dressed to kill. But what happened to your forehead, Richie, huh? Did someone get a little upset when you cleaned him out?"
"It's a shaving cut," Richie quipped, and he brushed Jerry's hand off his shoulder with a big wink and a shit-eating grin.
"How you been holding up, big guy? You miss me?"
Jerry pretended not to notice the insolent tone in his voice. He ushered Richie through the shop and into the back room. The poker table had been folded up and was leaning against a wall, awaiting the next game. The plastic chairs were stacked beside it in a neat little pile. Jerry crowded close and lowered his voice into a sly conspirator's murmur.
"I heard you've been on quite the winning streak lately. I guess that bad luck of yours had to turn around sometime, eh?"
Richie pulled an envelope out of his jacket and dropped it into Jerry's hands.
"Yeah, I've been doing okay. Next time you're gonna set this thing up, let me know. I'll drop in and show you boys how to play some poker."
Jerry's insulting grin faltered a notch or two. He leaned in even closer and breathed,
"Tell you what, Richie, I don't know what your new hustle is, and I don't care. But try that shit around here, kid, and I'll bust your head wide open."
"I don't think you would," Richie replied coolly. And for a brief second or two, he saw doubt on Big Jerry's face. Doubt, and possibly even a twinge of unease. Richie's entire persona had changed dramatically throughout the course of the past 7 days. There was a look in his eyes that Jerry Kinsella knew very well from his many years of associating with the Mafia. Whatever Richie may have once been, he was now a cold-blooded killer. He had killed to get what he wanted, and he would kill again. He wouldn't even think twice about it.
"Give me some room, fat man," Richie snapped, and Jerry flinched backward, thumping his generous behind into the wall hard enough to make the merchandise rattle on the shelves in the next room.
Jerry flushed as red as brick and spat,
"Get the hell out of here, creep! Go on! I don't want to see your face around here ever again!"
Richie let out a theatrical sigh of disappointment.
"That's a shame," he said. "I was looking forward to cleaning you out.
Oh well. Plenty of suckers elsewhere. Take her easy, Jerry."
He sauntered out the door with a sunny smile on his face and a spring in his step. He might be a creep, but he was also a winner, now and forevermore. The deck of cards tucked away in his jacket pocket would make it so. Richie decided a couple of beers would really hit the spot, a toast to his victory. And who knew? Maybe he'd stumble into a game somewhere. Life was full of surprises. He walked along 3rd Avenue, window shopping and humming to himself contentedly, and he eventually chose a bar at random. It was dark, clean, and blessedly quiet. He strolled up to the bar and told the bartender,
"Give me your fanciest imported beer, fella. I'm trying to learn how to appreciate the finer things in life. I'm a gentleman now."
The bartender gave him the blank look of someone who has been dealing with the public for far too long, and he said,
"Sure thing, boss. Coming right up."
Richie sipped his beer and looked around the bar. It was still early in the day, and the room was empty except for himself and the barkeep. That was fine by him. Other people were either a walking dollar sign or nothing at all. If he wasn't busy emptying their pockets, he didn't need them around. "To Golden Richie," he said, and poured a giant swallow of the overpriced lager down his throat.
to 1,000 victories, and then 1,000 more.
You seem like you're in a pretty good mood, the bartender called out from the other end of the bar. You win some money or something? Those threads you're wearing look brand new.
They are, and I did. Richie whooped, and he pounded his fist on the bar. I've been at the bottom for a long time, but now I'm on top. I'm a winner. You know what I'm saying?
Not really, the bartender grunted. To be honest, I don't get many winners rolling through here at 12:30.
Richie paused for a second, unsure if the bartender was making fun of him or not. Being the butt of someone else's joke was supposed to be a thing of the past. He felt a hot flare of anger in his heart, and he doused it with more beer. Screw it. Who cares what some bartender thinks? Richie was finally golden, and nothing could change that.
Mind if I smoke in here? He asked, and the bartender shrugged. Not supposed to smoke at the bar, but whatever. Here.
He slid a pack of matches down the bar, and Richie lit his cigarette with immense satisfaction. Perhaps he'd take up smoking fine cigars. Why not? He'd look good with a cigar. He'd look...
Richie's eyes happened to wander to the writing on the front of the matchbook, and the words froze his brain in mid-thought. The matches fell from nerveless fingers and fluttered to the floor.
Richie felt faint, and he gripped the bar to stop from sliding off his stool in shock. He'd seen this matchbook once before. It read, "Welcome to Uncharted Waters. Proprietor, Nelville Rawlings."
"Welcome back, Mr. Gold," the bartender croaked,
and now Richie could see that he was actually the rotting corpse of Nelville Rawlings, his aquiline features mottled by decay, and his formerly white dress shirt now brownish red with a crust of dried blood. Nelville plunked his letter opener from the bar and grinned.
"You were looking to join a card game, I believe. I just happen to know someone who has also been searching for a game, Mr. Gold. Would you like to meet him?"
Richie made a strangled sound in the back of his throat. His crotch went warm and wet as hot, terrified piss ran down his leg in a stream. Richie could see that he'd actually been sitting at the front counter of Nelville's curio shop, which was still a blood-spattered mess from his failed robbery. The shop was cloaked in gloom, and the air was rancid with decay. Richie promptly bolted for the door and ran straight into a large and immovable shadow. He let out a tiny shriek and staggered back, his mind a whirling chaos of panic. The shadow drifted closer and coalesced into an imposing figure in a long black cloak and a Stetson with a silver skull attached to the hatband. It was a man in late middle age, tall and still powerfully built in his advanced years. A cruel sneer twisted his lips beneath his heavy mustache, and his eyes burned like hellfire.
"Good day to you, sir," the man said in a lazy southern drawl. "My name is Travis Tanner, and I do believe you took something that doesn't belong to you. I'm here to take it back."
"I don't have them with me," Richie squeaked. "I'd have to go get them."
Travis raised an eyebrow and slowly shook his head.
"You can't bluff Travis Tanner, son. Not at the table, not anywhere. They're in your pocket. Hand 'em over, lickety-split."
Richie fished out the cards with a hand that couldn't stop shaking. Travis plucked the deck from his trembling fingers with a faint grimace of distaste and tucked them away in his cloak.
"You're a pissant," Tanner growled. "Ain't you?
A lowlife, bottom-feeding pissant. That's what you are.
This is a nightmare, Richie sobbed. This ain't... It isn't...
You killed my faithful servant, Travis said wonderingly. You should have died right then and there. Last bit of real luck you ever had, my friend. Because as soon as you laid your dirty hands on them playing cards, it was over.
Nelville's ghostly corpse came slumping around the counter, letter opener in hand. Richie held out his hands and dropped to his knees in supplication.
Aren't we supposed to play for it? He shrieked. Come on! Please, let me play for it! Just one lousy hand!
You already did, Travis said. You lost.
Richie looked down and saw that five of Tanner's cursed playing cards were fanned out in his hands. It was two pair, black aces and eights. A dead man's hand. The kicker was the Joker card, which depicted the dancing prisoner. Just like in Richie's nightmare, the Joker bore Richie's own face, and his eyes had been torn from their sockets. Travis showed him his own hand. It was a royal flush. The face cards were all pointing at Richie and laughing.
Please, Richie whispered. Please don't do this.
Winner takes all, Travis grinned. Come on now, Richie. You know that.
Nelville shambled forward, and Richie started to scream. He saw Travis Tanner smiling away in the background, absently shuffling his deck with fluid ease as he waited for the show to begin. And then Nelville was upon him, the letter opener glinting in the muted light, and Richie saw nothing at all.
You've just heard You Can't Bluff Travis Tanner by T.W. Grimm. T.W. Grimm is an author of horror and dark fiction from southwestern Ontario. He is the author of 99 Brief Scenes from the End of the World, Tripping Over Twilight, The Promises We Make in December, and A Different Kind of Magic. Well, friends, that just about wraps up our broadcast this evening. I'd like to extend my thanks to Joshua L. Hood and T.W. Grimm for providing tonight's stories. We're going to be continuing to work our way through this collection next week, and as a reminder, you can head to www.chillingbook.com right now to grab your own copy in paperback or ebook format. Thank you all for joining me tonight, and I hope to see you back next week. Until then, listeners, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot, and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com and we can talk details. That's ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.
What's up, baby? It's Bretzky, and I'm here to tell you that SpinQuest.com is giving out free sweeps coins. All you gotta do is purchase a $10 coin pack, and guess what? They're gonna give you the coins from a $30 coin pack. That lets you play all your favorite games like Blackjack, Wanted, Dead or Wild, and we're talking real cash prizes, baby. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey, sweetie, your mother showed me this Carvana thing for selling the car. I'm going to give it a try. Wish me luck. Me again. I put in the license plate. It gave me an offer. Unbelievable. Okay, I accepted the offer. They're picking it up Tuesday from the driveway. I haven't even left my chair. It's done. The car is gone. I'm holding a check. Anyway, Carvana, give it a whirl. Love ya.
So good, you'll want to leave a voicemail about it. Sell your car today on
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Mom, can you tell me a story?
Sure. Once upon a time, a mom needed a new car.
Was she brave?
She was tired, mostly. But she went to Carvana.com and found a great car at a great price. No secret treasure map required.
Did she have to fight a dragon?
Nope. She bought it 100% online. From her bed, actually.
Was it scary?
Honey, it was as unscary as car buying could be.
Did the car have a sunroof?
It did, actually.
Okay, good story.
Car buying you'll want to tell stories about. Buy your car today on
Carvana.
Delivery fees may apply.